Well, by the way, so the board is how it's best to apply the bill. And then they didn't, the top one was put up, and then they did the bottom. Okay, so let's get started. So this week it's a pleasure to bring Phil Pearl here to describe to us all things collapse models. Dr. Pearl is a professor at Hackman College in upstate New York. He did his undergrad and master's degree at MIT in electrical engineering and a PhD in physics. Also at MIT, right? And so today he'll be telling you how you can feel comfortable thinking that stakes are real, not have to deal with notions of multiple worlds. Namely, and he'll tell you all about the solution to that conundrum. So take it away. Oh, let's welcome Dr. Pearl. Happy to be here. I feel very Canadian because my daughter married a Canadian. Actually, he's a Canadian folk singer, part of the group Tanglefoot. He's a bass player with the bass voice. So I'm putting advertisement up here. That's a really important part of this talk. Actually, maybe I should also mention that Dr. Pearl has been kind enough to provide an assignment sheet for this week's lecture, so we should take very careful notes. These look like tough problems. We can appreciate the students. Okay, when I accepted this invitation from Joe, I was delighted to see that there were some notes on the web so that I could look at them and see what was going on this course. And I turned to the very first page of the very first note, and this is what I saw over here. And I disagreed with it thoroughly and completely. And I said, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? But then that was the only thing I disagreed with. Everything else I thought was really very, very nice. But I want to tell you why I disagree with this. A physical configuration, let's take it sentence by sentence. A physical configuration state is described by a state operator that is non-negative, Hermitian operator, with unit trace. Now, you've learned something now about what Joe calls a state operator, but I'm going to call it density matrix, because already to use the word state operator to describe this thing in rho, I think that's already prejudicing you, that the density matrix is something that describes an actual state of something, an actual state of something in nature, in fact. This is what's said here. A physical configuration is described by this density matrix or state operator. Now, you also learned in this course, however, that the density matrix is something which really describes, except in one very, very special case, doesn't describe a physical configuration. Despagnat talked about, very nicely, both talked about two kinds of ways to get the density matrix. One is simply you don't know what the physical configuration is. Well, it might be psi 1. And the probability, well, if you know, you're not sure, so you have a probability associated with your lack of knowledge, so it might be Q1, or it might be that one, or it might be some other one. It's not describing a configuration of nature at all, by itself anyway. It's describing something that you're not sure about. The other possibility is if you have a state vector, which describes both a, let's say, an apparatus or something in an environment, and you don't know much about the environment, so you decide to trace over the environment, and that's the way you get yourself a density matrix. That's another example where The density matrix is describing something which is not a complete amount of information, which is an incomplete amount of information. In both those cases, the density matrix, or what Joe pejoratively calls a state operator, isn't describing the state of nature at all. It's describing something about nature, but it's also describing something about your state of knowledge. And to me, I'm going to call this a possible zero, if you like. And this is actually a controversial statement, though you may not think so, that the job of theoretical physics is to make a correspondence between a symbol on a piece of paper and reality. Now, that's controversial because it's not all clear. I mean, it is, if you will, a religion, something that you believe in without any proof. Because it's not at all clear that you can describe reality. There's some people who say you can't describe reality. For example, Bohr said you can't describe reality. The best thing you can do is describe experiment. Not reality. Then there are people who believe that the state vector of quantum mechanics describes many worlds. And that's not the reality, at least that we know. I mean, it may be, they may in their minds think that it is a reality, but it's not the reality we know. What I mean by this reality, I think it's the reality in our particular world. So that's a possibility. That, and there are other possibilities as well. And so it is a little bit controversial to say that that the state vector of describes reality. In fact, I think this is something that many people here find very congenial, and Joe might even find it very congenial, that describes not reality, but knowledge of reality. Yeah?
Incidentally, actually, I'm surprised at your comments, because I chose this wording specifically to reflect a sympathy with the exact concerns you made. But I think the word state is also used not to describe physical reality, but for example, thermodynamic state, which is our most canonical state.
Yes.
You use the word state in physics to have situations of submaximal and incomplete. Mm-hmm.
So then you're saying that really it's the word configuration that you want to generalize. That is not the physical state of a system in nature. For example, an ensemble you would regard as configuration. And that's really what you meant by this. Okay. As I read it, I read that to be a collection of physical objects in the real world.
No, I think that physical collection of objects are not completely, but described by it. I didn't use
okay, so not completely described.
I specified later on, but it's implied that they're submaximal if they're not pure states.
I'll apologize. But I wanted to use that as a jumping off place.
The real test was you to ask the student what they understood.
That's what this student understood.
But we have pull up one person.
So that a symbol on paper, that's the job of theoretical physics, and the physics in fact can do that. That a symbol on a piece of paper corresponds to reality is not at all a given. But I'm going to suppose that that's so for what I'm talking about. I take that as part of my religion, part of my faith. And the second sentence here is that rank one projectors, this, called pure states, correspond to states of maximal knowledge. Maximal knowledge. See, we got out of this one. States of maximal knowledge. Now, to me, that is the thing which corresponds to the state of reality. That is, it's not a state of knowledge. There are people who believe that really that's the best that one can do, that one can never really understand or describe nature. I just disagree with it. But again, it's a question of faith. So I'm going to replace this postulate one by a different postulate one as far as I'm concerned, which is a physical configuration, a state is described by a state vector. And I guess I should write that down. The symbol psi at time t, state vector at time t, configuration at one instant of time. A non-pure density matrix, and I'm now using the word density matrix, not a state operator, but a density matrix, describes less than certain knowledge about the state. And I'm going to be concerned about certain knowledge about the state. So this is my postulate zero, so to speak, and this is my postulate one. That is to say, I'm going to suppose, and this also is a postulate, that is to say, it is also controversial. It is not an obvious thing that you can describe nature by a state vector. For example, there are other estimable models. I would regard, notice I don't call this wave function collapse theories. I call it models because theory is a little pretentious as far as I'm concerned. It's not really elevated yet to the state of the theory because it's a phenomenological description. There are parts of it which need to be completed. But there, for example, are people who do the de Broglie-Bohm model, in which case it's not the state vector, but the state vector as well as, or the wave function, as well as point particles, real existing point particles, which corresponds to the reality of nature. Or there's a recent book by Adler where he describes a classical matrices and derives quantum mechanics, or says he derives quantum mechanics from a classical statistical mechanics of the classical matrices. And in which case, the state vector, there is more to the description. The average behavior, statistical behavior, is what quantum mechanics is. And there's more to the description of reality than just the state vector. But I'm going to suppose that it is the state vector that corresponds to reality. This is a guess. Quantum mechanics is so successful in making predictions that I think it's a reasonable guess that one could, that nature may just do with the state vector and do with nothing else. So then, having said this, we now come to a problem which is often called, in physics, the measurement problem in the field of foundations of physics. I like to call it the reality problem. And you've all learned about this too. It's epitomized by Schrodinger's cat paradox, which actually was really due to Einstein, according to Arnold Fine, remember that Schrodinger argued that you could set a statistical situation where a quantum event would cause a cat to be in a superposed state of being killed by cyanide or not killed by cyanide. That is to say, the state vector of a certain instant of time would end up being alpha 1 cat alive plus alpha 2 cat dead. I'm going to generalize this to alpha 1 macro state 1 plus alpha 2 macro state 2. Where by macro state, I mean two states which, for example, of an apparatus measuring something, which if you looked at it, you don't need to be in there, or it could be in the state vector, I don't care. If you looked at it, you would see that there were two completely different configurations there. Einstein actually had a superposition of gunpowder, exploded or not exploded, and in the correspondence with Schrodinger, Schrodinger made it this much more dramatic thing with the cat, and Einstein very generously didn't even refer to the fact that it was his idea. He just said, your idea was marvelous. Problem is that when you start out with a state vector, like the cat alive, and you put it into its initial state vector, you put it into Schrodinger's equation, it evolves with time, and you get superposition like this. You get this kind of macroscopically distinct superposition all the time. And the problem is that this is not reality. Reality is macro state 1 or macro state 2. So that the ordinary Schrodinger evolution takes you from a state which corresponds to reality to a state which doesn't correspond to reality. And the wonderful phrase of Bell, which captures the whole problem in Boolean language, and is not or. And or is what we see in nature. So this problem was tackled by the Copenhagen people, and they said, well, you know, quantum mechanics is really a thing which describes just measurement. And they introduced the idea of the collapse postulate. Collapse postulate. Which is that when something like this is what you get with your state vector, you're a theoretical physicist and you calculate that, and you wait around twiddling your thumbs until an experimenter comes along and says, I got a result. It's back to state one. And you immediately go, oh, that's it. That's what you do. You change it to one or the other, depending upon what the experimenter says, because your information is being updated, and after all you're interested in doing is describing experiments. And they don't tell you exactly what is a measurement. It's very not well defined postulate. They don't tell you what a measurement is, so when you're supposed to apply this. They don't tell you that when you're making a measurement, what to put in your states and what not to put in your states. They don't tell you when or how to do the collapsing. What are the states that you should be doing the collapsing to? There's no fundamental statement of the rules for using this, but everybody knows how to use this. And by gosh, it works. It works remarkably, remarkably well. But is quantum mechanics or physics to be just about measurement? Einstein said, with regard to this, that I wrote down this quote somewhere. If this is so, then physics could only claim the interest of shopkeepers and engineers. The whole thing would be a wretched bungle. And Bell said, to restrict quantum mechanics to be exclusively about piddling laboratory experiments is to betray the great enterprise. And that is to say, quantum mechanics works so well, and there are intimations of grandeur there. It should be possible, one would think, to promote quantum theory from the theory of measurement to the theory of reality. But in order to promote quantum mechanics from the theory of measurement to the theory of reality, what you have to do is to be able to unambiguously say, what are the possibilities? That is, what are the unambiguous executive rules? What are the possibilities of realizable states? That is, the states that can actually occur in nature, and their probabilities. You have to be able to do that. Not the states just of measurement, but the actual states that we see in nature. You have to be able to say, someone gives you a state vector and say, this describes nature, you have to be able to pull out from that somehow what the realizable states are, and say what the probabilities of one of them actually appearing in the world is. So that's a big challenge. The situation requires the following, really. And if you look at this, this is going to be down the line. What I'm going to be doing today is I'm going to be discussing the formalism of quantum theory, the structure of, formalism of collapse models. I'm going to lead you to show you how they work. And next time on Thursday, I'm going to give you examples of how they work. That's to say, describe various experimental situations, see what the theory predicts, see what quantum theory predicts, standard quantum theory predicts, and then see if how the theory is testable. Because this theory is not going to be the same as quantum mechanics, because what seems to be called for here, you want to be able to have an evolution of the Schrodinger equation such that this sum doesn't appear, but one or the other appears. I'll have to modify that slightly because it'll be one plus a little bit of the other in the actual problem, in the actual solution of this. But that one state essentially appears. In order to do that, you have to modify Schrodinger's equation so it doesn't do this, that it the state vector, if it starts to do this, continues to evolve until you get this or this. Which means you have to change Schrodinger's own equation. By the way, Schrodinger was quite unhappy with the situation in quantum mechanics. And it's kind of ironic that one has to change Schrodinger's own equation if one wants to achieve what Schrodinger wanted to achieve, description of reality, which he initially started to do. So the idea is to modify Schrodinger's equation. And here's roughly how it's going to work. And what I'm going to do is successive approximations to the final proposal I'm going to make today. The standard Schrodinger equation is this. And what I want to do is add something else. And the something else is going to depend on something random. It's going to fluctuate. If it fluctuates, what this something else is going to do is collapse the wave function. That is to say, I'll specify more carefully in a moment what collapsing precisely means. But the idea is that something else is going to depend upon something random. And if it fluctuates one way, you're going to get this. If it fluctuates another way, you're going to get that. And the total number of fluctuations should be such that when you sum all the fluctuations that give you this, you should get the absolute magnitude of this squared. If that was, let's say, t equals 0, we have a superposition like that. You put it into the equation and see the equation doing the collapsing. It should give you this result with the probability this number squared, and this result with the probability that number squared. In so doing, the model takes quantum theory one step back, a step into the region where Bohr said you never could go. He said, never look behind quantum theory. You can't explain in terms of anything else. Well, this is an explanation in terms of something else. The reason that you get random results in making measurements and with those probabilities is because there is this fluctuating thing. It's going to be a field that exists in space and time. And that's the cause for the random behavior. If you knew precisely what that was, what that function of time was, you could predict every time what the result would be, and the results wouldn't be given by the probabilities of quantum mechanics. But it's because you don't know what this is. Yes?
So this is basically a hidden variable theory?
Yes and no. I would say yes, in the sense that the field here, W of XT, is something that you don't have direct experimental access to. Okay? And in that sense, it's a hidden variable theory. It is, we'll say yes. Okay, you can think of it that way. Okay, so the extra term also not only depends upon a fluctuating thing, W of X and T, but it depends upon an operator. And the operator is the thing which is going to distinguish what makes this macro state different from that macro state. And the operator is essentially, I'll eventually we'll get to where the fine points are made, it's an operator which represents the mass density in a certain volume of space. So what is being looked for is that these two states differ in their mass density. And if they just differ a little bit in their mass density, for example, one particle here plus one particle there, if you have, here's a region of space, and if the state vectors represent this plus this, one particle here plus one particle there, you can see the mass density is different. In this region of space, here there's no mass density, here there is some mass density. In this region of space, there's no mass density, here there is mass density. They differ in mass density. The collapse, there will be a collapse in this case, but very, very slowly. So if it's one particle, for example, which is undergoing an interference experiment, so that the wave function for the particle is going through two separated slits, so that you have a situation like this, a superposition of a particle going through the left, the upper slit and the lower slit, it will be a slow collapse, but if it was a rapid collapse, you wouldn't get any interference pattern, you know we get interference patterns, so it must be a slow rate of collapse. On the other hand, if this was an apparatus, and the apparatus pointer with many particles in it pointed either this way or pointed that way, there is a large mass density difference, and the collapse will be rapid. These ideas of how to go about doing this were contributed in a very, very important piece of work by Girardi, Romini, and Weber. And the theory I'm presenting to you is a combination of what I had been working on, this structure over here, and what they produced. And in my second lecture, I hope to be able to tell you something about the very lovely Girardi-Romini and Weber model, which has really been superseded by this, but it's still a very, very remarkable and wonderful thing to think about. Okay. This being a different evolution of the state vector than Schrodinger's equation, it is, as I say, testable. And that will be the subject of my second lecture. OK. So now, first question is, how can you go about doing this? How can you technically achieve this collapse of the wave function? I'm going to give you a classical analogy to this. And it's a very precise analogy. Suppose you start out with a state vector at a time 0. I'll make it simple. Alpha 1 of 0, state 1, plus alpha 2 of 0, state 2. And at a later time t, it's alpha 1 of t times 1 plus alpha 2 of t times 2. And I'm going to define x sub n, well, x sub I equals 1 or 2. 1 or 2 of t is defined as the absolute magnitude of alpha I of t squared. Okay? Now, suppose you have this stochastic process. What's going to happen? Well, you expect to have the following. Suppose I was to graph x1 and x2 on the same graph. Here's 0, and here's 1. And here is, this is a time axis. And let's say, this we'll talk about x1. Suppose x1 starts with alpha 1 of 0, absolute magnitude squared. It might be, for example, 0.36. And x2 might start at 0.64. So the two squared amplitudes add up to 1. Well, what the random dynamics would do would be to have these things go jiggling around, and I have to draw it, and I'm not going to be able to do it, so that one goes down, the other one goes up, so that the sum always adds up to 1. But eventually, you're going to, if there's to be collapse, what you want to have happen is that one of these, let's say the one that started here, by dint of strength, ends up here at 1. And then this one ends up at 0, and that's a collapse. Okay? A perhaps better, simpler way for me to draw that would be to, here's x1, and here's x2. Here's x1 equals 1, x2 equals 1. And since the sum of the two add up to 1, they're on the line, x1 plus x2 equals 1. And you start a single point here. Let's put it up here. 0.36 and 0.64. And this point with time jiggles around over here like this until finally it ends up over here. That's the kind of dynamics you want. Yes?
Is there a proposition to measure the actual rate of collapse?
I have no proposition. It can be done. It can be done. For example, an experiment that would test this is the following. Suppose you had a blob. And as I said, for a single particle, it's very hard to see this experimentally. But you'd need something like 10 to the minus 7 centimeter radius blob of mercury is all you would need for the theory I'm going to propose to do an interference experiment with it. Now, nobody's gotten there yet. Anton Zeilinger, we'll be talking later in this course, has done experimental interference with something called a buckyball, which I hope to talk about on Thursday, which is carbon 60 carbons in a Buckminster forward kind of arrangement. And he's actually done a two-slit interference experiment with that structure. If you had something somewhat larger, as the wave packet describing the two, as the wave packet describing the object goes through the two slits and comes out the other side, you have the superposition of a packet here and a packet there. Because there's mass density difference in these two states here or there, the wave function is going to start playing this game. It's going to start fluctuating. The amplitude is going to fluctuate. And when they're finally combined, these two packets on the screen, the contrast, the interference pattern would not be the same as if no wave packet collapse had occurred. If total wave packet collapse had occurred, then one of the packets would completely disappear, and all you'd see on the screen would be the diffraction pattern of the slit itself, no interference pattern at all. So you could, yes, you can do experiments to test, to see this collapse if it's taking place. No one has yet done an interference with an object which is large enough, but the first experiment that Anton did about 20 years ago was with a neutron, and then he's gone up to carbon-60 in 20 years. So give another 20 years or 40 years, and we'll get it. Yeah. Oh, sorry, you and yeah.
I was just wondering, if it evolves stochastically like that, what stops the function, the state from uncollapsing?
That's a very good question, because I'll be writing some equations down on the board. There is, there's always a possibility, as you see when I give the analogy that I'm going to give, that this is almost up here at one, and then there's some kind of reversal, and in fact it is a flip, what I call a flip. So there is a probability of that happening. The closer this gets to one, the less probable it is. In fact, the probability, one can actually work out what the probabilities are, that, you know, it could be like the probability of an egg jumping off the ground at a certain point. So that one, but in principle, that could happen, in the theory, that could happen.
But what I mean is, once it is at one.
Yeah. Oh, what once it is at one.
Yes. Why does it stop evolving?
Well, okay. Now, I'm going to give you an analogy, and it's going to be obvious why, in this analogy, why it stops. But in the theory itself, there is nothing to stop it, except the fact that it is extremely close to one, and so that the state vector really is. At a later time, it's something like 1 minus epsilon. The epsilon is fluctuating, and usually the probabilities are all fluctuating even smaller, plus epsilon times Mathis gate 2. And this is something that philosophers, particular Abner Shimoni, have objected to. This is called the Tails problem. How can you say that something like this, doesn't this have to equal 0 completely, and have that be completely 1 before you can say this truly corresponds to a macroscopic state? And there's a whole discussion I could give and may give, I'm not sure I'll have enough time, as to why I can call this being almost one and this being almost zero, in fact, identify it as this. Okay. Professor Girardi has given a very nice description, I've given another description, in terms of mass density, that the mass density of this is essentially the mass density of this. It's so small a difference from it that experimentally it's undetectable. In a moment, I'll answer your question in terms of the simple model I have. What stops it? Okay. Yes, you have a question.
Yeah, so are you saying the particles collapse? Because I think those particles where they self-gravitate?
No, I'm not giving any model for this fluctuating thing. That's an open question. It really is. And that, I think, is one of the most important questions to be solved. You identify this fluctuating thing, this field, with something physical.
Did you tell
Rose's
model a special case?
No, Roger has a postulate which can be implemented this way, but he doesn't go that far because it has no structure that he's willing to go with. I'll have a collapse rate parameter in theory, and if that essentially is proportional to the gravitational constant, which, by the way, was thought of earlier, it was thought of by Leo Spiozzi before Roger lent the weight of his. Well, something like it was rather than something different, but before he left, the weight of his authority and his insights into it. Okay, so I'm going to give an analogy to this. Yes?
This theory clearly to me, not time reversible.
That is right.
And so does it have a relationship, or could it perhaps even derive like the second law of thermodynamics?
This is what Sid Adler has argued. His model has as the zeroth order derivation quantum mechanics, as the first order correction, he likes to say it gives the interpretation of quantum mechanics. And what he means by that is this. So he derives this, he says he derives this from statistical mechanics. Okay. Let me give you an example. It's called the gambler's ruin game. And let's take my example that I gave before. Suppose gambler 1 has $64, and gambler 2 has $36. the beginning of the game. So this is 0.64, and that's 0.36. When they start playing the game, a coin is tossed. If heads, gambler one gets a dollar from gambler two. Tails goes the other way. You can see that's precisely this behavior. And until finally, there's $1 left that gambler one has, and coin is tossed and gambler one loses, and then gambler one doesn't have any money left, and all the money is possessed by gambler two. And then, to answer your question, the game stops because who wants to play with a guy who doesn't have any money left? At least in this example, the game ends. And that's the reason. Some time ago, I made models which were different from the one I'm going to propose here, in which there was diffusion, and it's diffusion with absorbing boundaries. You can make some equations that are similar to this with diffusion with absorbing boundaries. And when you have absorbing boundaries, that's essentially like a particle which moves along, and then there's a piece of glass at the end, and the particle sticks to the glass. So that's a way of cheating. But it's not, in fact, the model I'm going to present here. Okay, and now, I claim that gambler one, who starts off with 0.64 of the money, what fraction of the games will gambler one win? Gambler one will win 0.64 of the games, fraction of the games. In other words, that's exactly what you want. That is to say, x1 of, well, we'll say time infinity, but it's before time infinity, because the games always end. Because all kinds of, all this requires is a fluctuation of 36 in one direction. When you toss coins, all possible fluctuations take place. A fluctuation of 36 means the game's over. So I'll call it time infinity for simplicity, but it's some finite time. X1 of infinity will equal 1 64% of the time. Okay? Now, that's exactly what goes on in the gambler's ruin game is exactly the behavior of the x's that you want to have in the quantum mechanical case. And the simplest proof, which I'm going to give a little bit more complicated proof, which is applicable to the quantum situation, but the simplest proof is let p of x be the probability you, or the gambler, you have x fraction of the money, and then go on to win the game. Okay? So, if you have all of the money, you're certain to go on to win the game. If you have none of the money, you're certain not to go on to win the game. And now, you can write a very simple difference equation for p of x. It's equal to the probability you lose the next toss, so then you have x minus 1/100, and that probability is 1/2, and then you go on to win the game. So you lose the toss, you then have x minus 100 money, but this is the probability you then go on to win the game, or you win the next toss, and then go on to win the game. That's a very simple difference equation. The solution of it is p of x equals ax plus b. It's a second order difference equation, so that if you have a solution with two constants in it, then you've got the solution. You just plug that in, it's very easy to see that it satisfies this. And now apply the boundary conditions. P of 1 equals 1, so p of 1 is equal to a. P of 0 equals b, so that's 0. So the probability of winning with when you have x of the money, I'm sorry, sorry, this is 1. That's right. P of 1 equals a times 1, that's right. So a is 1. So the probability a times 1 equals 1, so a equals 1. So the probability of winning when you have X amount of the money is X. And that's precisely what you want to have the quantum mechanical behavior taking place. Okay, now I'm going to write this in a form more suitable for utilization with the quantum mechanical case, and give you three postulates, which, if anything obeys these three postulates, then you have a collapse behavior. So suppose psi at a time t is equal to sum over n of alpha n of t a n, and define xn of t is defined as the absolute magnitude of alpha n of t squared. So those are the x's. And here are the three properties that you need. One is simply the sum over all n of xn of t for any t is equal to 1. And you know that that's true for normalized state vectors in quantum mechanics. And of course, it's true for the Gamble-Zwilling game. By the way, I'm asking you, a homework problem, I'm asking you to do to prove these properties here for the Gamble-Zwilling game. Now, the second one is if you take the ensemble average over all possible games of xn at any time t, that's equal to xn at time 0. The mathematicians, the fact that this mean value does not change, it's called the Martingale property. And I'm asking you in the homework problem to prove that that's true for the Gamble-Zwilling game. And I'm giving you some clues as to how to do that. And the third one, which is the very crucial one and very powerful one, is essentially the statement that the game ends. Always games always end for the Gamble-Zwilling game. It is that xn at time infinity times xm at time infinity, the average value of that over the ensemble is 0. For n not equal to m. And I claim from this you can prove that there is going to be collapse behavior. That is to say, the collapse behavior means that that the only possibilities are that xn of infinity goes to 1 and x not equal to n at infinity goes to 0. That occurs with probability xn at time 0. Okay. So let's see how to prove that. We start with property 3, which is the very powerful property. And let me just write out what the average value of expectation value of that is. Let p infinity of x1 on up to x, well, I'm putting a number at the top, but capital xn, be the probability for the ensemble of games of having this particular configure, x1 equals 0.22, x2 equals 0.07, etc., etc. And the mean value, all integrals from 0 to 1, of xn, xm, the statement that this equals 0, statement that equals 0. Okay. Now, these are all, the point is these are all positive quantities in here. So how can the integral of a bunch of positive quantities equal zero? Only if the probability, and I'll give you some examples, the probability here has to be zero when for all possible values of x's except x possibly x equaling zero or x equaling one. The probability is measured is non-zero. For example, for xn is proportional to delta of xn, delta of xm is proportional to that, the probability is that, then you get yourself zero. But it doesn't need to be proportional to delta of xn, xm. It could be delta of xn, xn minus anything, except this has to be true for all n and n. In which case, the only possibility is if the probability vanishes everywhere, except for one of the x's being 1 and all the rest being 0. Let me give an example here. Let's go to this example of here's x1, and here's x2, and here's the line over here. And doing this integral, then we have just the integral of p of x1, x2, dx1, dx2, x1, x2, and that has to equal 0. Well, how can it equal 0? If p has any non-zero measure over here, because the x's are positive, it's not going to be 0. The only possibility is if you have all the probability over here, which is x1 equaling 1 and x2 equaling 0, or the other possibility is the probability of that. The probability can only have non-zero measure over there and over there. It can't have non-zero measure anywhere else. It's the only way this can be achieved. Essentially, we'll just do it through 3 so you can see what's going on here. Here's x1, here's x2, here's x3. You notice that here I'm using property 1 here. That it can't be that all of them vanish. That is, they have to lie on this line, because this is the line for this example, x1 plus x2 is 1. And for this case, it'll be x1 plus x2 plus x3 equals. So here I'm using property 3 and property 1. Property 1 says that the probability only lies on this triangular region. The integral of the probability times x1, x2, x2, x3, x3, x1 has to vanish. And it can't be something in the middle here, because then probability is integral wouldn't vanish. Yeah.
Should we read that top line as for all n not equal to m?
Thank you. Thank you very much. The probability can't be, let's say, can't be over here, because while x3 is, probability here is that it's a probability measure for x3 being 0, so that x3, x1 average and x3, x2 average would be 0, but x1, x2 average would not be 0. So the only way that you can get this to be true for all combinations of these is if the probability lies here and here. So the application of 3 and 1 imply that that the probability of x1 to xn is equal to some constant times delta of x1 minus 1, x2 being 0, on up to xn, plus et cetera, et cetera. A2 delta of x1, x2 minus 1, delta of x3, delta of xn, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's what you get from postulates 3 and postulate 1. And then finally, we apply postulate 2, the martingale property. And that is to say, xn of 0, the initial value of x, is equal to xn bar. In this particular case, at time infinity, because this is the probability at time infinity, little subscript infinity over here. And what's that equal to? It's the integral of p infinity of x1 to xn, xn. And when you perform the integral, only the nth term contributes, and this is a n. So that in fact, an is x n of 0. And so what have we got? The various possibilities are all collapsed possibilities. One of the x's is 1, all the rest is 0. And what's the total measure? Integrate this, for example, over all x. This is going to be x1 of 0. So the probability is the initial value of x. And that's how you achieve collapse. OK, so I've done some algebraic stuff and not talked really about quantum mechanics at all. So now let me start talking about quantum mechanics. Let me start off by giving you what I call CSL Lite, L-I-T-E as in the theory. OK, I'm going to give you an evolution equation for a state vector. OK, so to collapse a state vector to eigenstates of the operator A, where, sorry, Hermitian operator A, here's the evolution equation. So I'm going to be, this theory has two equations in it. One is the evolution equation. Given any, well, in this particular case, see what I call it, light, because it depends upon a function single function b of t minus 2 lambda t a squared psi 0. A is the operator to whose eigenstate I claim the state vector is going to collapse. Lambda is a parameter, which is essentially a rate parameter. If it's a big number, it's going to be a fast collapse. If lambda is a small number, it's going to be a slow collapse. I'm not yet positing what I call full-blown CSL, or full-blown continuous spontaneous localization model. I call these models all CSL models, continuous spontaneous localization. B of t is an arbitrary function of time of Brownian class. That is to say, it is continuous but not differentiable. So it's just like a random walk kind of thing, like that. And this is the state vector evolution I'm going to posit, which I claim has collapsed behavior. And the second thing I have to do, though, is I say that if you put any b of t in here, you can calculate the state vector. Okay? But what's the problem? I have to tell you the probability that nature gives you that b of t. Therefore, that is, gives you that state vector. Yes?
Sorry, what was A again?
Oh, capital A is an operator that has to be put into the theory. It's going to be, as you'll see, the operator to which, whose eigenstates, that is, these eigenstates, collapse will take place. So when time goes to infinity, the eigenstate, the state vector is going to be one of these things. So I have to put in something to determine what the physical states are. In the full-blown CSL, it will be this mass density operator. Here, it's just, this is the simplest example I can give you of how this theory works. So I've got to give you a probability rule. And the probability rule is that at time t, the probability that b or b of t has a certain value is just this. The scalar product of the state vector with itself times dB divided by the square root of 2 pi lambda t. Because this is not a unitary evolution. There's no I up here. This is a non-unitary evolution, which means that the norm squared of the state vector is not 1. And so roughly speaking, what this is saying is if your evolution is such that the state vector becomes very small in norm squared, that's not a likely thing to happen. But if it's large norm squared, it's likely to happen. This is the whole theory. And even for full-blown CSL, it will be similar. I'll simply give you the evolution equation and the probability rule. And you can then go ahead and calculate anything you want to calculate. That's it. That's the way the theory works. Okay. So let's see how it works. I gave you, as a homework problem, proving that this obeys these properties that I have put over here, because I can show you how it works directly. I don't use the postulate. But it obeys those postulates, as you're going to prove for homework. Suppose the initial state vector is the sum of alpha n a n. Okay? Then plug this in, and let's just see what happens. With psi of t, put it in, the operator a acts on this, you end up with alpha n a n e to the minus 1 over 4 lambda t, b of t minus 2 lambda a sub nt, because these are eigenstates. So these are the magnitudes. This times this are the magnitudes of a sub n. And the probability that that this is the b, that the particular b takes place, probability of b, bb, is simply the scalar product of this with itself. And that is the sum over the absolute magnitude alpha n squared, because these are orthogonal states. And you square this, e to the minus 1 over 2 lambda t, b of t minus 2 lambda a sub n t squared. Okay? Now, to see how this works, As I say, I'm going to give you a homework problem where you can rigorously prove that those postulates are satisfied, but you can just look at this and see how it works in the following way. Suppose I first concentrate on this, and I graph.
Did you drop the DB normalization?
Thank you. I need it. Thank you. I would have found it eventually. Let's just look at these numbers here. The mean value, these are Gaussians, so the shape is like that. Yeah?
Sorry, what's lambda?
Oh, lambda, as I mentioned, is it's a parameter of the theory. It's a collapse rate parameter. You give a number, and that's it.
Okay.
It's a, you put it in. So the theory requires a parameter. We'll see that the full blown CSL requires two parameters. Okay. So what does one of these things look like? It looks like this. Its mean position is at 2 lambda a sub n t. Its width is the square root of lambda t. Square root of lambda t is the width. And the area under it, the area under it is the absolute magnitude of alpha n squared. So phi looks like that. Another mean, let's say this is a 1. This mean is 2 lambda a 2 t. The area under that is the absolute magnitude of alpha 2 squared, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now, you see what's happening here. As long as the eigenvalues are distinctly different, and so this is what the collapse is going to work on, the eigenvalues of A have to be different if you're going to get a collapse to one or the other of these different states. The eigenvalues are the same, you're going to collapse to a superposition of the state. So let's suppose all the A's are different. If they're all different, what's happening is the distance between them is getting larger and larger for time. So this picture, they started out all on top of each other, but at t equals 0, but as time goes on, the faster ones move further away. And secondly, the width is square root of lambda t. It's not. This distance is growing faster than the width is growing. So the picture I've drawn here is an accurate picture. So these are the only b's that are possible. I mean, all b's are in principle possible, but some b down here, this is, I'm graphing here, versus b. Some b down here is possible, but it's not probable. So you don't even worry about it. If a state vector occurs with zero probability, doesn't mean anything. So you can see that for b's, and if you wait long enough, you can get as big a separation between as you like. You can see that for b anywhere in this region here, if I integrate over all b's in this region, I get a contribution only from the one term, the first term, and the area under this is a normalized Gaussian, so the area under this is 1. All those b's give rise to a state vector. In a moment I'll say what that is. A state vector for which the probability is the absolute magnitude of alpha 1 squared. And what state vector is it? Well, if b is in this region here, this is the same as this is, except for the 4 lambda t over here, instead of the 2 lambda t. So for b in this region, the only state vector which survives, that is, which as time goes to infinity, all the rest of these things have a smaller and smaller contribution, is the state vector at time t is proportional to a, or in this case, a mod. And similarly. That is, the b's, to summarize, the b's can only be in certain regions, and when the b's are in those regions, then the sum total of the probability is the probability associated with the collapse rule of standard quantum theory, and the state vector ends up being not normalized to 1, but you can always normalize the state vector to 1. This kind of a theory, the norm of the state vector is unimportant, as important to the probability rule, but it's not important in the sense that it is in quantum mechanics. The normalization of state vectors in quantum mechanics of equal 1 is a required because the sum of probabilities has to equal 1. But here the sum of probabilities is 1 for a different reason, because of this probability rule, and so the ray, or phase, invariance of ordinary quantum mechanics, doesn't matter what you multiply the state vector by, EVRV doesn't matter. This also, in this theory, it's the norm independent as well. It doesn't matter what you multiply the state vector by, it's still the same state vector. It's direction in Hilbert space that counts, not the norm of the vector. Okay. Let me just construct for you the density matrix. As I said, you have these two postulates, and so everything follows from that. So let's calculate the density matrix as an exercise. What's the density matrix? Well, it's the integral over all b of the probability of b. Let me write it out this way. That's psi t b, psi t b, dB over square root of 2 pi lambda t times this state vector. Let me just put this. But wait, this is not the normalized state vector. The density matrix is constructed from taking the probability of the state vector of a pure state, multiplying it, because you don't know which one it is, multiplying it by this combination of the pure states, but they must be normalized. What's the normalization? Why, it's this. That is, if you want to normalize the state, you've got to multiply it by the square root of this. So two of these, you get it squared. This cancels with this, and that's the density matrix. So now you can just plug in what the state vector is. And then you can do the integral. The integral is problem 1 in your homework. This is the sum of n of alpha n, alpha n complex conjugate, a n. The integral over b of this Gaussian is the following. If you integrate two normalized Gaussians, the product of two normalized Gaussians with certain means, what happens is you get a Gaussian, which is the difference of the means divided by the sum of the variances, but have to be normalized Gaussians. So I'm going to put a square root of 4 pi lambda t here, and a square root of 4 pi lambda t here, but I've got to multiply this by the square root of 4 pi lambda t in order not to change my equation. And then you get a, 4 pi lambda t times the integral of this, which is e to the minus 1 over 8 lambda t to lambda a m t minus 2 lambda a m t squared here, and I have to have this normalized, which is the square root of 2 pi 8 lambda t, and I should not forget my square root right at the beginning, square root of 2 pi lambda t. And so you see this, and this all cancel. And we end up with Two lambda NEMT, you get four lambda, so four lambda squared, t squared, divided by eight lambda t, so you get lambda over 2t, a sub n minus a sub n squared. Okay? So that's the density matrix in this case, and you can look at it and say, well, of course, the on diagonal elements, when n equals m, the amplitudes are just the absolute magnitude of alpha n squared, the initial probabilities. And the off-diagonal elements, because an is not equal to am, decay exponentially with the collapse rate. Now, you could look at this and say, well, when do you do that first? I mean, that means collapse. No, it doesn't. It doesn't necessarily mean collapse. There are many ways of getting the same density. Yeah, sorry.
What happened to B of T?
Oh, I integrated over it. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I should perhaps have done this.
The path to realization?
This is the probability of, this is the probability of a particular B of T. These depend upon B of T. So each B of T is a different probability. I'm summing or integrating over all B of T's, all the state vectors, and that's what you end up with. Okay? I've given you this as a homework problem. You can get, yeah, sorry. Yes.
I don't see why you just wrote
it. Because this the what you're proving in problem one is the integral of two normalized Gaussians is a normalized Gaussian. So this is the square root of 2 pi 8 lambda t. Square root of 2 pi 8 lambda t times the square root of 2 pi lambda t. Is 8 times 2 is 16, and the square root of that is 4. So 4 pi lambda t comes out of the denominator, and 4 pi lambda t is in the numerator. Okay. So that's how it cancels.
Do the homework.
Okay.
You should recover standard quantum mechanics in some limit. I guess the lambda going to 0.
Well, you got to be careful here. I would say without the term being there. And it should actually be lambda being infinite. Because I guess that would work. Well, no, it would work. See, if lambda goes to infinity, then your rate of collapse is, lambda is 1 over, the amount of time is 1 over lambda. So you want lambda to go to 0, so the amount of collapse times infinity. Yes. When lambda goes to 0, that'll do it. Yeah. When lambda goes to 0, this becomes e to the minus infinity. Okay. Which is, you don't have any, the state vector, yeah, because this is an unnormalized state vector. Remember, so I'd have to divide this by the norm squared, and I think I would then get the initial state vector I started with. Okay. But I would prefer to think of either the terms there or it ain't there. Yeah.
I think what he was getting at is that you should have a factor of root 2 left over.
I shouldn't. The square root of 2 pi 8 lambda t squared 2 pi lambda t is square root of 16 pi squared lambda squared t squared square root of 16 is 4. 8 times 2 is 16. Oh, sorry, this 4 pi lambda t is up here.
No, well, on the bottom you have root 32.
Excuse me?
Yeah,
there's a factor of room 2.
I'm sorry. You're confusing me. Isn't square 16 4?
But there's also room 2 over there.
I'm sorry. You're right. Where do I go? Okay. Sorry. It's 2 pi 4 lambda t. 2 pi 4 lambda t because the normalization, thank you. Thank you very much. The normalization is square root of pi, whatever is down here, whatever the here is, 2 times the variable square root. Okay, there it is. Okay. So, now I just want to make this point. This density matrix behavior can be achieved in many ways, and a homework problem that I've given you is to have an evolution where you simply have the phases, random phases, and you can get exactly the same density matrix if this is just this times e to the I something b. So you have to be wary of false collapse. There's false collapse and there's true collapse. Just because the density matrix looks like collapse doesn't mean it really is collapse. Okay.
So how does somebody know?
You have to look at the state vector. You have to know what the state vector is. The density matrix doesn't do it for you. The state vector is.
Somebody does an experiment.
The way you know is because you see something. That is to say, in an experiment, you see one outcome or the other, so you know that the state vector has collapsed.
But how do you know it's collapsed? With non-linearity?
You know it's collapsed. That's all I'm going to say. That's how you know. In other words, there is no experiment that's going to show you a collapse taking place. That didn't make it just a complete description of experiments, but there are experiments from which the density matrix of this theory is different from the density matrix of quantum mechanics, and so that there will be experiments that can test the efficiency system. Okay, let me just make a generalization, and then I'm going to go to CSL slightly heavier, or CSL-like. That is to say, the case of many A's. So many A's, so which all compete with each other. So in that case, there are many B's, and so that the evolution equation, the probability rule is the same for all lambda t, the sum over all r of b sub r of t minus 2 lambda t a squared psi 0. This is the state vector evolution. And the density matrix, I'll just write down for you. Well, I'll write it down between the a m state, make it up there. It's alpha m complex conjugate, e to the minus lambda t over 2, the sum over all a r n minus, oh sorry, put an r here, a r n minus a r m. That is to say, a r acting on a state a n is the eigenvalue of the operator a r. This state would be the direct product of all the eigenstates of the a's. So the point of this is, if the states that you have, these states an, differ in many ways, but many distinguishable ways in terms of commuting operators, then the collapse rate, and you can look also at the evolution of the individual state vectors and see, in fact, that they are, you get collapsed the same way. But the more differences, the merrier. The more differences between the eigenvalues of different operators, the faster the collapse goes. Okay, now I want to do CSL slightly heavier, which is getting closer to the final CSL that I'm going to be proposing. And that is, the state vector evolution is not going to depend upon, the reason I did this example is because the mathematics is simpler than the mathematics here. The state vector is going to depend upon white noise, which is the rate of change of B of t. And you'll see in a moment why this is the preferred. This is the evolution equation. The probability rule is the same form. That is, what do I mean by this? Here, W of t is any function of white noise class. A function of white noise class is take a random walk and take the derivative of it. So it's not continuous and it's not differentiable. So it's, you know, really a full collection of wild functions. The probability rule is the probability at time t of w, and I'll write dw here, is the same rule. But what do I mean by dw? In order to calculate things, you have to discretize time. That is to say, this you can think of as writing this as e to the minus 1 over 4 lambda times dt times the sum over tj equals 0 to tj, well, let's say j equals 0 to j equals t over dt of w of tj minus 2 lambda a squared. That is to say, each w at each time is an independent variable. And so you can integrate it from minus infinity to infinity. You can take any value between minus infinity and infinity. And dw is dw is the product of all j of dw of tj, and I have to, when I discretize, I have to divide by the Tupper normalization factor, which is the square root of 2 pi 2 lambda over dt. So it's the square root of 4 pi lambda over dt. Think of this as this over dt, and that's the normalization factor you need. So when you integrate over all of these, you get 1. But when you integrate the probability of all of these, you get 1. Okay. All right, now let me show you how this is equivalent to what we previously discussed. So that then the demonstration of collapse before becomes a demonstration of collapse here. All you have to do is expand this. And what do you get when you integrate? 4 lambda, okay? Well, the integral from 0 to t, dt prime, of w squared of t prime, minus 4 lambda a w of t, but I'm going to write w as dt prime dt prime, and then plus 4 lambda squared a squared. So I just expanded that out. And now, we just pull out the first factor, which is just a time-dependent factor, so it's an overall factor, so it doesn't affect anything. And the remaining terms are integral of dv of t prime, dt prime times dt prime, which is dv of t prime integrated from 0 to t, and assume that d of 0 is 0. So I get minus 4 lambda a v of t, and then this last term is 4 lambda squared a squared times psi of 0. But now, if I multiply this by e to the plus something and multiply by e to the minus something, and the something is going to be 1 over 4 lambda t d squared of t, and e to the minus 1 over 4 lambda t b squared of t. And these are, again, just a numerical factor, which everyone has to worry about in the probability rule, but since I don't have the time to do it, I have to be done carefully to assure you that it works. If I combine this and this, I just get e to the minus something times e to the minus 1 over 4 lambda t b of t minus 2 lambda t a squared. I should put a t here because I've integrated this over time. So this term is the same as that one. The cross term here is the same as this one. And I just put in that term here. So this is, in fact, the previous example I gave you. Yes?
I thought you said w was non-differentiable.
It is non-differentiable.
What,
it can be written as the function of, well, you mean b is non-differentiable, you meant.
No, w, because you say w is the rate of change of b.
Yes,
that
yes. Yeah, so I'm not writing the derivative of w, I'm writing w as the derivative of something else.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but what you meant to say is that b is non-differentiable, it's continuous but non-differentiable. But what it is this behavior of b is continuous but non-differentiable, so the derivative of b with respect to t doesn't exist. Well, it exists as white noise, but you have to make sure that you define white noise that you define it properly. As a function, it doesn't exist, but as there's something called the Wiener process, which is a construction, and I don't want to go into making this rigorously correct. But if you just treat these as functions, just treat this function, okay? The best thing for you to do is think of this. This can be any old damn thing, okay? The majority of W of T's are just going like crazy like that. But you can think of any approximation to it, which is continuous in the limit as the approximation, as the continuity goes away, and the analysis is okay, all right? Okay, so now the reason I'm doing this is because in this form, I can finally add the Schrodinger evolution, which is, let's see, am I running over, am I not? How much time do I have?
Seven more.
What, do I have some more time? Okay. I want to now give you what you do if you want to make this into a more complete theory by adding the Hamiltonian evolution as well as the collapse evolution. You notice the collapse evolution I've been discussing is there only if the Hamiltonian is zero. When the Hamiltonian and the collapse are fighting each other, you may not get complete collapse, because as things start to collapse, then they're moved by the Hamiltonian evolution. For example, one of the problems I'm giving you for homework is to make A the position operator for a free particle. And H, which I'm going to write down in a moment, is p squared over 2m. And what happens there is that the Schrodinger evolution wants to spread a wave function, but the collapse evolution wants to narrow the wave function. And what happens, the net effect is, which you can calculate and will calculate, is that there's an equilibrium size for the wave function. If you start with a Gaussian, you end up with a Gaussian which has an equilibrium size, where those two effects are canceling each other out. So this is the time order of e to the minus I, of e to the minus the integral from 0 to t, dt prime of I h plus 1 over 4 lambda integral from 0 to t, dt prime w of t prime minus 2 lambda a squared, psi of 0. That's how you add the Hamiltonian evolution. Okay, and the tau is the time ordering operator, and I don't know how familiar are you with it.
Yeah, well, the integral repeated twice on the second argument. If you want the leftmost square bracket, maybe to be.
I want both of these under my bracket.
Under the integration.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, don't need that. Thank you. Good. Thank you. Okay, so I have just a few more minutes. We could do some manipulations with this, and in fact, for homework, you are going to do some manipulations with this. You're going to put a equal to x, and h equals p squared over 2m. You're going to take the derivative of this with respect to time, which gives you the Schrodinger equation modified, which is minus I h minus 1 over 4 lambda w of t minus 2 lambda a squared psi t. And you're going to put this p squared over 2 m x over here, and you're going to make an ansatz, a guess, that the solution of a Gaussian form, e to the minus ax squared plus bx plus c, where a, b, and c depend upon time, will be a solution. You'll plug it in, and you'll find that indeed it is a solution, and you'll find what happens to the width. What I want to end up doing is give you what I would call full-blown CSL, now that you've had this introduction, which is simply this example with many A's. And for each A, you're going to have a different W. So if W depends upon position and time, and this is an integral over all positions, so this is a sum for, there's a different W at each position. You must think of a different W at each position of space. And this operator A is going to be a function of x. This is without the h, but the h in is obviously generalized. This is the final form of CSL, or continuous spontaneous localization. I named it that. I had been doing these modifications of Schrodinger equations for some time, but I was really stuck. I didn't know how to mechanically go about choosing the preferred basis, what A is, and I didn't know how to, I was turning on my equations by hand and turning them off by hand. I knew that you had to turn on the collapse with a large coefficient when there was a macroscopic difference between states, and they turned on with a very small coefficient when there was a small difference between states, but I didn't know how to do it. Along came a paper by Girardi, Rimini, Weber, which wasn't this kind of a thing, but which showed me how to do it. I'm going to discuss that in the next lecture. But let me just say what A is. A of x is essentially is proportional to the mass in a sphere around the point x of radius A, little a. And Girardi, Rimini, Weber chose 10 to the minus 5 centimeters for the A, so there's two parameters involved. It's a microscopic parameter. You need it because if you have collapse, this is one thing that stuck me completely. If you have collapse the position eigenstates, you give an infinite amount of energy. And I just could not get around that. But they got around it very cleverly. A of x is 1 over pi, a squared to the 3/4. You can think of this essentially as a step function, something which is roughly speaking 1 when x and z are close to each other, close to being within the radius A, and 0 outside the sphere of radius A, multiplied by the operator, which is the number density operator for, if this is just one part, one moment I'll tell you what the great proposal is. This number density operator, those of you who know what the creation annihilation operators of particles at a position, that's what n of z is. So a is 10 to minus 6 centimeter. GRW made a specific proposal, and although these numbers are actually experimentally detectable, and there's a limit on the range now by experiments, well within the limit is these two numbers. So this was their proposal, and I see no reason to change them now. There's been no experimental reason to change them now. If you want to get all particles, and this is really what you want to do, as I'll show you next time, experiment demands that there be mass proportionality. So if you replace n of z by, I'll call it mi, ni of z, but it has to have the dimensions of number, so we'll divide by the mass of the proton, so that this is the rate of collapse of a single proton in a superposition of here plus there. It takes 10 to the 16 seconds. 10 to the 16 seconds is around 300 million years. So it's a long time, and they won't, if they collapse for a proton in a superposition, or a neutron, which you got to experiment with Zeilinger did, in a superposition of here plus there takes that long, it's not going to interfere with Zeilinger's interference experiment. So we'll think of the same thing. Experiment demands this, as I will show you. This is the mass of the proton neutron, doesn't matter. And this would be, the I here would be the sum of all the particles that you're interested in talking about. Electrons, neutrons, protons, pions, whatever you want. Okay, so let's see if there's any last few minute words I want to say. Oh, yes. Okay, just let me say one last thing. So if I add the Hamiltonian, I then have this. I'll write it this way so you can time order it properly, because the Hamiltonian could depend upon time in principle. So you add a Hamiltonian, and that is your equation of evolution. The probability rule I've given you already, and that's it. You go ahead and calculate. So next time we'll go ahead and calculate and see what the theory predicts, and see what aspects of it are experimentally testable, and how one could try to compare it to quantum theory. Thank you. Any, don't do type of question.
No, there's no time.
Oh, the time? Yeah.
When the people from the and this noise
for a single particle, for example. It's also true, by the way, for a larger object, the center of mass wave function will both randomly fluctuate, will jiggle around randomly, but also will achieve equilibrium size. And that, in fact, is an experimental test of this theory, that an object will randomly jiggle. So I and a colleague have proposed an experiment, which so far nobody's picked up on because it's a difficult experiment. But to look at something like 10 to the minus 5th centimeter little sphere and see a jiggle.
My question though is that size, does it have anything to do with like an observing principle?
As you'll see from the homework problem, the growth definitely has to do with the observing principle. That is to say, it's a competition between the Schrodinger spread of wave packet, and the wave packet spreads, because of the uncertainty principle. That is to say, delta x is equal to p over m times the width of the wave packet times delta t. I have this right. Yes. So, it can be right. That's not right. Sorry.
Which bar? Over N. Yes, okay.
So that's the uncertainty principle, that that something with certain delta x is certain delta p, and therefore will spread. Okay? What you're asking about is there a similar kind of uncertainty principle within this? No, I mean, the uncertainty principle is the uncertainty principle. So it really is simply a competing shrinking with the uncertainty principle generated spread of the wave. There's a nice paper by Angelo Bassi on this recently, which has recently been put up on the web.
Yeah. I'm worried about a typo, actually.
Yeah.
A, in A of X is an operator phi set up in the top line. A of X, the very top line. That's an operator, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, you shouldn't have two exponentials. Anything should be the argument in one exponential.
It doesn't matter when you time order. That's the lovely thing about time ordering, that time ordering will take care of itself. You know, the time ordering of e to the minus, you know, any kind of sum of a of t e to the minus I, b of t, where I'm summing over all times, very small times, is equal to e to the minus I, a of time zero. You can take the product, or you can take them separate, it doesn't matter, e to the minus I, a of delta t, plus b of delta t, on up, way out to t itself. It doesn't matter what you do with it, because the cross terms, it's only the 1 minus I, a terms that are important. The cross terms are the integral when you do the integral. An integral, when I have dt's in there, that's when they're negative. I should have put my dt's in there. Yeah. Yes?
Why don't you do the mercury drop experiment?
I left engineering in the early 60s. In the late 50s, actually. Physics is a very specialized subject, as you know, and there are people who are very good at experimental work, and I'm not one of them. So I have to be good at convincing people. I'm not very good at that either. Yeah.
Is there any reason to accept experiment that you give mass density such an important place in this model?
Yeah. The original theory, which I'll GRW, the mathematical formalism of collapse here, I was working on since the early 70s, so I didn't have it in this beautiful form here. Girardi, Rimini, and Weber didn't have mass density, but they had collapse on locations of positions, which I'll explain to you next time. In order to make this formulation is not a modified Schrodinger equation. To convert it to a modified Schrodinger equation, one of the problems with their collapse mechanism is it destroys symmetry. When you have a collapse according to GRW, a anti-symmetrized wave function for electrons and neutrons and protons loses its anti-symmetry, so that's not good. So I had to have a density here, and I put a number density here. But then, I actually assumed, I didn't have any reason for choosing one way or another, that the collapse rate would be the same for electrons, neutrons, and protons. Everything's full of electrons, neutrons, and protons. Why to make them the same? But then there's an experiment, which I'll describe next time, which looks, but experiment which actually will distinguish between the collapse rate between electrons and neutrons and protons. And it turns out that the collapse rate for electrons is way, way lower than the collapse rate for neutrons and protons, and in fact has to be mass. The experimental evidence is very close enough to predicting that it's mass proportional. It's within a few. You'll see. Okay, it's pretty close to it. So that I'm really forced to that. Now I could put something else here, you might think, but the slogan for this kind of theory I like to say is what you see in nature is what you get from the theory. You have to put something here that will distinguish between a pointer here and a pointer there, a macroscopic superposition here and there. Mass density seems to be a natural thing. If you can think of something else, you can publish. Put another A in here, show that it agrees with all experiments ever performed so far, which this thing does, which is not such an easy thing to do. And so far, this is this is the one that works.
Okay. Well, there's a talk at 4, so we should probably be in the room with questions we follow up on Thursday. So thank our speakers.